trouble getting off to sleep tonight, that's all, after a very busy and productive day. The air in the room was stale. It smelled of dirty sheets and an unwashed body. "We need to be careful here," the assistant DA said. "He's impaired right now. His lawyer's going to say he's not fully capable of understanding Miranda, so we can't let him say anything. And if he does say something, we can't listen." Emerson called for the paramedics, told them to check Barr out, to make sure he wasn't faking, and to make sure he wasn't about to die on them. They fussed around for a few minutes, listened to his heart, checked his pulse, read the prescription label. Then they pronounced him reasonably fit and healthy, but fast asleep.
"Psychopath," the SWAT commander said. "No conscience at all."
"Are we even sure this is the right guy?" the assistant DA asked. Emerson found a pair of dress pants folded over a chair and checked the pockets. Came out with a small wallet. Found the driver's license. The name was right, and the address was right, and the photograph was right.
"This is the right guy," he said.
"We can't let him say anything," the ADA said again. "We need to keep this kosher."
"I'm going to Mirandize him anyway," Emerson said. "Make a mental note, people."
He shook Barr by the shoulder and got half-opened eyes in response. Then he recited the Miranda warning, the right to remain silent, the right to a lawyer. Barr tried to focus but didn't succeed. Then he went back to sleep.
"Okay, take him in," Emerson said.
They wrapped him in a blanket, and two cops dragged him out of the house and into a car. A paramedic and the ADA rode with him. Emerson stayed in the house and started the search. He found the scuffed blue jeans in the bedroom closet. The crepe-soled shoes were placed neatly on the floor below them. They were dusty. The raincoat was in the hall closet. The beige Dodge Caravan was in the garage. The scratched rifle was in the basement. It was one of several, resting on a rack bolted to the wall. On a bench underneath it were 5 9-millimeter handguns and boxes of ammunition, including a half-empty box of Lake City M852 168-grain boat tail hollow point 308s. Next to the boxes were glass jars with empty cartridge cases in them, ready for recycling. Emerson thought, ready for hand-loading. The jar nearest the front of the bench held just 5 of them. Lake City brass. The jar's lid was still off, like the 5 latest cases had been dumped in there recently and in a hurry. Emerson bent down and sniffed. The air in the jar smelled of gunpowder, cold and old, but not very. Emerson left James Barr's house at 4 in the morning, replaced by forensic specialists who would go through the whole place with a fine-tooth comb. He checked with his desk sergeant and confirmed that Barr was sleeping peacefully in a cell on his own with round-the-clock medical supervision. Then he went home and caught a 2-hour nap before showering and dressing for the press conference. The press conference killed the story stone dead. A story needs the guy to be still out there. A story needs the guy roaming, sullen, hidden, shadowy, dangerous. It needs fear. It needs to make everyday chores exposed and hazardous, like pumping gas, or visiting the mall, or walking to church. So to hear that the guy was found and arrested even before the start of the second news cycle was a disaster for Ann Yanni. Immediately, she knew what the network officers were going to think. No legs. Over and done with. History. Yesterday's news. Literally. Probably wasn't much of anything anyway. Just some inbred heartland weirdo too dumb to stay free through the night. Probably sleeps with his cousin and drinks Colt 45.
nothing sinister there. She would get one more network-breaking news spot to recap the crime and report the arrest, and that would be it. Back to obscurity. So Ann Yanni was disappointed, but she hid it well. She asked questions and made her tone admiring. About halfway through, she started putting together a new theme, a new narrative. People would have to admit the police work had been pretty impressive, and this perp wasn't a weirdo, not necessarily. So a serious bad guy had been caught by an even more serious police department, right out there in the heartland, something that had taken considerable time on the coasts in previous famous cases. Could she sell it? She started drafting titles in the back of her mind. America's Fastest? Like a play on Finest? The chief yielded the floor to Detective Emerson after about 10 minutes. Emerson filled in full details on the perp's identity and his history. He kept it dry. Just the facts, ma'am. He outlined the investigation. He answered questions. He didn't boast. Ann Yanni thought that he felt the cops had been lucky, that they had been given much more to go on than they usually got. Then Roden stepped up. The DA made it sound like the PD had been involved in some early minor skirmishing and that the real work was about to begin. His office would review everything and make the necessary determinations. And yes, Ms. Yanni, because he thought the circumstances warranted it, certainly he would seek the death penalty for James Barr. James Barr woke up in his cell with a chemical hangover at 9 o'clock Saturday morning. He was immediately fingerprinted and re-Mirandized once and then twice. The right to remain silent. The right to a lawyer. He chose to remain silent. Not many people do. Not many people can. The urge to talk is usually overwhelming. But James Barr beat it. He just clamped his mouth shut and kept it that way. Plenty of people tried to talk to him, but he didn't answer. Not once. Not a word. Emerson was relaxed about it. Truth was, Emerson didn't really want Barr to say anything. He preferred to line up all the evidence, scrutinize it, test it, polish it, and get to a point where he could anticipate a conviction without a confession. Confessions were so vulnerable to defense accusations of coercion or confusion that he had learned to run away from them. They were icing on the cake. Literally the last thing he wanted to hear, not the first. Not like on the TV cop shows, where relentless interrogation was a kind of performance art. So he just stayed out of the loop and let his forensics people complete their slow, patient work. James Barr's sister was younger than him and unmarried and living in a rented downtown condo. Her name was Rosemary. Like the rest of the city's population, she was sick and shocked and stunned. She had seen the news Friday night, and she caught it again Saturday morning. She heard a police detective say her brother's name. At first, she thought it was a mistake, that she had misheard, but the guy kept on saying it. James Barr. James Barr. James Barr. Rosemary burst into tears. First, tears of confusion, then tears of horror, then tears of fury. Then she forced herself to calm down and got busy. She worked as a secretary in an 8-man law firm. Like most firms in small heartland cities, hers did a little bit of everything, and it treated its employees fairly well. The salary wasn't spectacular, but there were intangibles to compensate. One was a full package of benefits. Another was being called a paralegal instead of a secretary. Another was a promise that the firm would handle legal matters for its employees and their families free, gratis, and for nothing. Mostly that was about wills and probate and divorce and insurance company hassles after fender benders. It wasn't about defending adult siblings who were wrongly accused in notorious urban sniper slayings. She knew that, but she felt she had to give it a try, because she knew her brother, and she knew he couldn't be guilty. She called the partner she worked for at home. He was mostly a tax guy, so he called the firm's criminal litigator. The litigator called the managing partner, who called a meeting of all the partners. They held it over lunch at the country club. From the start, the agenda was about how to turn down Rosemary Barr's request in the most tactful way possible. A defense to a crime of this nature wasn't the sort of thing they were equipped to handle, or inclined to handle. There were public relations implications. There was immediate agreement on that point. But they were a loyal bunch, and Rosemary Barr was a good employee who had worked many years for them. They knew she had no money because they did her taxes. They assumed her brother had no money either. But the Constitution guaranteed competent counsel, and they didn't have a very high opinion of public defenders, so they were caught in a genuine ethical dilemma. The litigator resolved it. His name was David Chapman. He was a hard-scrabble veteran who knew Roden over at the DA's office. He knew him pretty well. It would have been impossible for him not to, really. They were two of a kind, raised in the same neighborhood and working in the same business, albeit on opposite sides. So Chapman went to the smoking room and used his cell phone to call the DA at home. The two lawyers had a full and frank discussion. Then Chapman came back to the lunch table. "It's a slam dunk," he said. "Miss Barr's brother is guilty all to hell and gone. Roden's case is going to read like a textbook. Hell, it's probably going to be a textbook one day. He's got every kind of evidence there is. There's not a chink of daylight anywhere." "Was he leveling with you?" the managing partner asked. "There's no bullshitting between old buddies," Chapman said. "So? All we would have to do is plead in mitigation. If we can get the lethal injection reduced to life without parole, there's a big win right there. That's all Miss Barr has a right to expect. Or her damn brother, with all due respect." "How much involvement?" the managing partner asked. "Sentencing phase only, because you'll have to plead guilty."
"You happy to handle it?"
"Under the circumstances."
"How many hours will it cost us?"
"Not many. There's practically nothing we can do."
"What grounds for mitigation?"
"He's a Gulf War vet, I believe, so there's probably chemical stuff going on, or some kind of delayed post-traumatic thing. Maybe we could get Roden to agree beforehand. We could get it done over lunch."
The managing partner nodded, turned to the tax guy.
"Tell your secretary we'll do everything in our power to help her brother in his hour of need."
Barr was moved from the police station lockup to the county jail before either his sister or Chapman got a chance to see him. His blanket and pajamas were taken away, and he was issued paper underwear, an orange jumpsuit, and a pair of rubber shower sandals. The county jail wasn't a pleasant place to be. It smelled bad, and it was noisy. It was radically overcrowded, and the social and ethnic tensions that were kept in control on the street were left to rage unchecked inside. Men were stacked three to a cell, and the guards were short-handed. New guys were called fish, and fish were left to fend for themselves. But Barr had been in the army, so the culture shock for him was a little less than it might have been. He survived as a fish for 2 hours, and then he was escorted to an interview room. He was told there was a lawyer waiting there for him. He found a table and 2 chairs bolted to the floor in a windowless cubicle. In one of the chairs was a guy he vaguely recognized from somewhere. On the table was a pocket tape recorder, like a Walkman. "My name is David Chapman," the guy in the chair said. "I'm a criminal defense attorney, a lawyer. Your sister works at my firm. She asked us to help you out." Barr said nothing. "So here I am," Chapman said. Barr said nothing. "I'm recording this conversation," Chapman said, "putting it on tape. I take it that's okay with you?" Barr said nothing. "I think we met once," Chapman said. "Our Christmas party 1 year?" Barr said nothing. Chapman waited. "Have the charges been explained to you?" he asked. Barr said nothing. "The charges are very serious," Chapman said. Barr stayed quiet. "I can't help you if you won't help yourself," Chapman said. Barr just stared at him, just sat still and quiet for several long minutes. Then he leaned forward toward the tape machine and spoke for the first time since the previous afternoon. He said, "They got the wrong guy. They got the wrong guy," Barr said again. "So tell me about the right guy," Chapman said immediately. He was a good courtroom tactician. He knew how to get a rhythm going. Question, answer, question, answer. That was how to get a person to open up. They fell into the rhythm, and it all came out. But Barr just retreated back into silence. "Let's be clear about this," Chapman said. Barr didn't answer. "Are you denying it?" Chapman asked him. Barr said nothing. "Are you?" No response. "The evidence is all there," Chapman said. "It's just about overwhelming, I'm afraid. You can't play dumb now. We need to talk about why you did it. That's what's going to help us here." Barr said nothing. "You want me to help you?" Chapman said, "or not?" Barr said nothing. "Maybe it was your old wartime experience," Chapman said, "or post-traumatic stress, or some kind of mental impairment. We need to focus on the reason." Barr said nothing. "Denying it is not smart," Chapman said. "The evidence is right there." Barr said nothing. "Denying it is not an option," Chapman said. "Get Jack Reacher for me," Barr said.
"Who?"
"Jack Reacher." "Who's he, a friend?" Barr said nothing. "Someone you know?" Chapman said. Barr said nothing. "Someone you used to know?"
"Just get him for me."
"Where is he? Who is he?" Barr said nothing. "Is Jack Reacher a doctor?" Chapman asked.
"A doctor?"
Barr repeated. "Is he a doctor?" Chapman asked. But Barr didn't speak again. He just got up from the table and walked to the cubicle's door and pounded on it until the jailer opened it up and led him back to his overcrowded cell. Chapman arranged to meet Rosemary Barr and the firm's investigator at his law offices. The investigator was a retired cop, shared by most of the city's law firms. They all had him on retainer. He was a private detective with a license. His name was Franklin. He was nothing like a private eye in a TV show. He did all his work at a desk with phone books and computer databases. He didn't go out, didn't wear a gun, didn't own a hat. But he had no equal as a fact checker or a skip tracer. and he still had plenty of friends in the PD.
"The evidence is rock solid," he said. "That's what I'm hearing. Emerson was in charge, and he's pretty reliable. So is Roden, really, but for a different reason. Emerson's a stiff, and Roden is a coward. Neither one of them would be saying what they're saying unless the evidence was there."
"I just can't believe he did it," Rosemary Barr said.
"Well, certainly he seems to be denying it," Chapman said, "as far as I can understand him. And he's asking for someone called Jack Reacher, someone he knows or used to know. You ever heard that name? You know who he is?"
Rosemary Barr just shook her head. Chapman wrote the name Jack Reacher on a sheet of paper and slid it across to Franklin.
"My guess is he may be a psychiatrist. Mr. Barr brought the name up right after I told him how strong the evidence is, so maybe this Reacher guy is someone who can help us out with the mitigation. Maybe he treated Mr. Barr in the past."
"My brother never saw a psychiatrist," Rosemary Barr said.
"To your certain knowledge?"
"Never."
"How long has he been in town?"
14 years, since the army."
"Were you close?"
"We lived in the same house."
"His house?" Rosemary Barr nodded. "But you don't live there anymore."
Rosemary Barr looked away. "No," she said. "I moved out."
"Might your brother have seen a shrink after you moved out?"
"He would have told me."
"Okay. What about before, in the service?"
Rosemary Barr said nothing. Chapman turned back to Franklin.
"So maybe Reacher was his army doctor," he said. "Maybe he has information about an old trauma. He could be very helpful."
Franklin accepted the sheet of paper.
"In which case, I'll find him," he said.
"We shouldn't be talking about mitigation anyway," Rosemary Barr said. "We should be talking about reasonable doubt, about innocence."
"The evidence is very strong," Chapman said. "He used his own gun."
Franklin spent 3 hours failing to find Jack Reacher. First, he trawled through psychiatric associations. No hits. Then he searched the Internet for Gulf War support groups. No trace. He tried LexisNexis and all the news organizations. Nothing. Then he started back at the beginning and accessed the National Personnel Record Center's database. It listed all current and former military. He found Jack Reacher's name in there easily enough. Reacher had entered the service in 1984 and received an honorable discharge in 1997. James Barr himself had signed up in 1985 and mustered out in 1991. So there was a 6-year overlap. But Reacher had been no kind of a doctor, no kind of a psychiatrist. He had been a military cop, an officer, a major, maybe a high-level investigator. Barr had finished as a lowly specialist E-4, infantry, not military police. So what was the point of contact between a military police major and an infantry E-4? Something helpful, obviously, or Barr wouldn't have mentioned the name, but what? At the end of 3 hours, Franklin figured he would never find out, because Reacher fell off the radar after 1997, completely and totally. There was no trace of him anywhere. He was still alive, according to the Social Security Administration. He wasn't in prison, according to the NCIC, but he had disappeared. He had no credit rating. He wasn't listed as title holder to any real estate or automobiles or boats. He had no debts, no liens, no address, no phone number, no warrants outstanding, no judgments entered. He wasn't a husband, wasn't a father. He was a ghost. James Barr spent the same 3 hours in serious trouble.
It started when he stepped out of his cell. He turned right to walk down to the payphones. The corridor was narrow. He bumped into another guy, shoulder to shoulder. Then he made a bad mistake. He took his eyes off the floor and glanced at the other guy and apologized. A bad mistake, because a fish can't make eye contact with another prisoner, not without implying disrespect. It was a prison thing. He didn't understand. The guy he made eye contact with was a Mexican. He had gang tattoos, but Barr didn't recognize them. Another bad mistake. He should have put his gaze back on the floor and moved on and hoped for the best. But he didn't. Instead, he said, "Excuse me." Then he raised his eyebrows and half-smiled in a self-deprecating way like he was saying, "This is some place, right?" Bad mistake. Familiarity and a presumption of intimacy.
"What are you looking at?"
the Mexican said. At that point, James Barr understood completely. "What are you looking at?" That was pretty much a standard opener. Barrack rooms, bar rooms, street corners, dark alleys. It was not a phrase you wanted to hear. "Nothing," he said, and realized he had made the situation much worse.
"You calling me nothing?"
Barr put his eyes back on the floor and moved on, but it was way too late. He felt the Mexican stare on his back and gave up on the payphone idea. The phones were in a dead-end lobby, and he didn't want to feel trapped. So he walked a long counterclockwise circuit and headed back to his cell. He got there, okay. Didn't look at anyone, didn't speak. He lay down on his bunk. About 2 hours later, he felt okay. He guessed he could handle a little macho bluster. And he was bigger than the Mexican. He was bigger than two Mexicans. He wanted to call his sister. He wanted to know she was okay. He set off for the payphones again. He got there unmolested. It was a small space. There were four phones on the wall, four men talking, four lines of other men waiting behind them. Noise, shuffling feet, crazed laughter, impatience, frustration, sour air, the smell of sweat and dirty hair and stale urine. Just a normal prison scene, according to James Barr's preconceptions. Then it wasn't a normal scene. The men in front of him vanished, just disappeared. They just melted out of sight. Those on the phone hung up mid-sentence and ducked back past him. Those waiting in line peeled away. In half a second, the lobby went from being full and noisy to being deserted and silent. James Barr turned around. He saw the Mexican with the tattoos. The Mexican had a knife in his hand and 12 friends behind him. The knife was a plastic toothbrush handle wrapped with tape and sharpened to a point, like a stiletto. The friends were all stocky little guys, all with the same tattoos. They all had cropped hair with intricate patterns shaved across their skulls.
"Wait," Barr said.
But the Mexicans didn't wait, and 8 minutes later, Barr was in a coma. He was found sometime after that on the floor, beaten, pulpy, with multiple stab wounds and a cracked skull and severe subdural bleeding. Afterward, jail talk said he had had it coming. He had disrespected the Latinos. But jail talk said he hadn't gone quietly. There was a hint of admiration. The Mexicans had suffered a little, but not nearly as much as James Barr. He was medevaced to the city hospital and sewn up and operated on to relieve pressure from a swollen brain. Then he was dumped in a secure intensive care unit, comatose. The doctors weren't sure when he would wake up again. Maybe in a day. Maybe in a week. Maybe in a month. Maybe never. The doctors didn't really know, and they didn't really care. They were all local people.
The warden at the jail called late at night and told Emerson. Then Emerson called and told Roden. Then Roden called and told Chapman. Then Chapman called and told Franklin.
"So what happens now?" Franklin asked him.
"Nothing," Chapman said. "It's on ice. You can't try a guy in a coma."
"What about when he wakes up?"
"If he's okay, then they'll go ahead, I guess."
"What if he isn't?"
"And they won't. Can't try a vegetable."
"So what are we doing there?"
"Nothing," Chapman said. "We weren't taking it very seriously anyhow. Barr's guilty all to hell and gone, and there's nothing much anyone can do for him."
Franklin called and told Rosemary Barr, because he wasn't sure if anyone else would have taken the trouble. He found out that nobody else had, so he broke the news himself. Rosemary Barr didn't have much of an outward reaction. She just went very quiet. It was like she was on emotional overload.
"I guess I should go to the hospital," she said.
"If you want,"
Franklin said.
"He's innocent, you know. This is so unfair."
"Did you see him yesterday?"
"You mean, can I alibi him?"
"Can you?"
"No,"
Rosemary Barr said.
"I can't. I don't know where he was yesterday, or what he was doing."
"Are there places he goes regularly? Movies? Bars? Anything like that?"
"Not really."
"Friends he hangs with?"
"I'm not sure."
"Girlfriends?"
"Not for a long time."
"Other family he visits?"
"There's just the two of us. Him and me."
Franklin said nothing. There was a long, distracted pause.
"What happens now?"
Rosemary Barr asked.
"I don't know, exactly."
"Did you find that person he mentioned?"
"Jack Reacher?" "No, I'm afraid not. No trace."
"Will you keep on looking?"
"There's really nothing more I can do."
"Okay,"
Rosemary Barr said.
"Then we'll have to manage without him."
But even as they spoke, on the phone late at night on Saturday, Jack Reacher was on his way to them. Chapter 2 Reacher was on his way to them because of a woman. He had spent Friday night in South Beach, Miami, in a salsa club with a dancer from a cruise ship. The boat was Norwegian, and so was the girl. Reacher guessed she was too tall for ballet, but she was the right size for everything else. They met on the beach in the afternoon. Reacher was working on his tan. He felt better, brown. He didn't know what she was working on, but he felt her shadow fall across his face and opened his eyes to find her staring at him, or maybe at his scars. The browner he got, the more they stood out, white and wicked and obvious. She was pale, in a black bikini. A small, black bikini. He pegged her for a dancer long before she told him. It was in the way she held herself. They ended up having a late dinner together, and then going out to the club. South Beach salsa wouldn't have been Reacher's first choice, but her company made it worthwhile. She was fun to be with, and she was a great dancer, obviously. Full of energy, she wore him out. At 4 in the morning, she took him back to her hotel, eager to wear him out some more. Her hotel was a small Art Deco place near the ocean. Clearly, the cruise line treated its people well. Certainly, it was a much more romantic destination than Reacher's own motel, and much closer. And it had cable television, which Reacher's place didn't. He woke at 8 on Saturday morning when he heard the dancer in the shower. He turned on the TV and went looking for ESPN.
He wanted Friday night's American League highlights. He never found them. He clicked his way through successive channels and then stopped dead on CNN because he heard the chief of an Indiana police department say a name he knew. James Barr. The picture was of a press conference. Small room, harsh light. Top of the screen was a caption that said, Courtesy NBC. There was a banner across the bottom that said, Friday Night Massacre. The police chief said the name again, James Barr. And then he introduced a homicide detective called Emerson. Emerson looked tired. Emerson said the name for a third time, James Barr. Then, like he anticipated the exact question in Reacher's mind, he ran through a brief biography. 41 years old, local Indiana resident, U.S. Army infantry specialist from 1985 to 1991, Gulf War veteran, never married, currently unemployed. Reacher watched the screen. Emerson seemed like a concise type of a guy. He was brief, no bullshit. He finished his statement and, in response to a reporter's question, declined to specify what, if anything, James Barr had said during interrogation. Then he introduced the district attorney. This guy's name was Roden, and he wasn't concise, wasn't brief. He used plenty of bullshit. He spent 10 minutes claiming Emerson's credit for himself. Reacher knew how that worked. He had been a cop, of sorts, for 13 years. Cops bust their tails and prosecutors bask in the glory. Roden said James Barr a few more times and then said the state was maybe looking to fry him. For what? Reacher waited. A local anchor called Ann Yanni came on. She recapped the events of the night before. Sniper slaying. Senseless slaughter. An automatic weapon. A parking garage. A public plaza. Commuters on their way home after a long work week. 5 dead. A suspect in custody, but a city still grieving. Reacher thought it was Yanni who was grieving. Emerson's success had cut her story short. She signed off, and CNN went to political news. Reacher turned the TV off. The dancer came out of the bathroom. She was pink and fragrant and naked. She had left her towels inside.
What shall we do today?
She said, with a wide Norwegian smile. I'm going to Indiana, Reacher said. He walked north in the heat to the Miami bus depot. Then he leafed through a greasy timetable and planned a route. It wasn't going to be an easy trip. Miami to Jacksonville would be the first leg. Then Jacksonville to New Orleans. Then New Orleans to St. Louis. Then St. Louis to Indianapolis. Then a local bus, presumably, south into the heartland. 5 separate destinations. Arrival and departure times were not well integrated. Beginning to end, it was going to take more than 48 hours. He was tempted to fly or rent a car, but he was short of money and he liked buses better, and he figured nothing much was going to happen on the weekend anyway. What happened on the weekend was that Rosemary Barr called her firm's investigator back. She figured Franklin would have a semi-independent point of view. She got him at home, 10 o'clock in the morning on the Sunday.
I think I should hire different lawyers, she said.
Franklin said nothing.
David Chapman thinks he's guilty, Rosemary said. Doesn't he? So he's already given up.
I can't comment, Franklin said. He's one of my employers. Now Rosemary Barr said nothing.
How was the hospital? Franklin asked.
Awful. He's in intensive care with a bunch of prison deadbeats. They've got him handcuffed to the bed. He's in a coma, for God's sake. How do they think he's going to escape?
What's the legal position?
He was arrested but not arraigned. He's in a kind of limbo. They're assuming he wouldn't have gotten bail.
They're probably right.
So they claim under the circumstances it's like he actually didn't get bail. So he's theirs. He's in the system like a twilight zone.
What would you like to happen?
He shouldn't be in handcuffs. And he should be in a VA hospital, at least. But that won't happen until I find a lawyer who's prepared to help him.
Franklin paused. How do you explain all the evidence?
I know my brother.
You moved out, right?
For other reasons, not because he's a homicidal maniac.
He blocked off a parking space, Franklin said. He premeditated this thing.
You think he's guilty, too?
I work with what I've got, and what I've got doesn't look good.
Rosemary Barr said nothing.
I'm sorry, Franklin said. Can you recommend another lawyer?
Can you make that decision? Do you have a power of attorney?
I think it's implied. He's in a coma. I'm his next of kin.
How much money have you got?
Not much.
How much has he got?
There's some equity in his house.
It won't look good. It'll be like a kick in the teeth for the firm you work for.
I can't worry about that.
You could lose everything, including your job.
I'll lose it anyway, unless I help James. If he's convicted, they'll let me go. I'll be notorious by association. An embarrassment.
He had your sleeping pills, Franklin said.
I gave them to him. He doesn't have insurance.
Why did he need them?
He has trouble sleeping.
Franklin said nothing.
You think he's guilty?
Rosemary said.
The evidence is overwhelming, Franklin said.
David Chapman isn't really trying, is he?
You have to consider the possibility that David Chapman is right.
Who should I call?
Franklin paused.
Try Helen Roden, he said.
Roden?
She's the DA's daughter.
I don't know her.
She's downtown. She just hung out her shingle. She's new and she's keen.
Is it ethical?
No law against it.
It would be father against daughter.
It was going to be Chapman. And Chapman knows Roden a lot better than his daughter does, probably. She's been away for a long time.
Where?
College. Law school, clerking for a judge in D.C.
Is she any good?
I think she's going to be.
Rosemary Barr called Helen Roden on her office number. It was like a test. Someone new and keen should be at the office on a Sunday. Helen Roden was at the office on a Sunday. She answered the call sitting at her desk. Her desk was second-hand, and it sat proudly in a mostly empty two-room suite in the same black glass tower that had NBC as the second-floor tenant. The suite was rented cheap through one of the business subsidies that the city was throwing around like confetti. The idea was to kick-start the rejuvenated downtown area and clean up later with healthy tax revenues. Rosemary Barr didn't have to tell Helen Roden about the case, because the whole thing had happened right outside Helen Roden's new office window. Helen had seen some of it for herself, and she had followed the rest on the news afterward. She had caught all of Ann Yanni's TV appearances. She recognized her from the building's lobby and the elevator.
"Will you help my brother?"
Rosemary Barr asked.
Helen Roden paused. The smart answer would be, no way. She knew that. Like, no way, forget about it, are you out of your mind?
two reasons. One, she knew a major clash with her father was inevitable at some point, but did she need it now? And two, she knew that a new lawyer's early cases defined her. Paths were taken that led down fixed routes. To end up as a when-all-else-fails criminal defense attorney would be okay, she guessed, all things considered. But to start out by taking a case that had offended the whole city would be a marketing disaster. The shootings weren't being seen as a crime. They were being seen as an atrocity. Against humanity. Against the whole community. Against the rejuvenation efforts downtown. Against the whole idea of being from Indiana. It was like L.A. or New York or Baltimore had come to the heartland, and to be the person who tried to excuse it or explain it away would be a fatal mistake, like a mark of Cain. It would follow her the rest of her life.
"Can we sue the jail?"
Rosemary Barr asked.
"For letting him get hurt?"
Helen Roden paused again. Another good reason to say no. An unrealistic client.
"Maybe later," she said.
Right now he wouldn't generate much sympathy as a plaintiff, and it's hard to prove damages if he's heading for death row anyway.
"Then I can't pay you much,"
Rosemary Barr said.
"I don't have money."
Helen Roden paused for a third time. Another good reason to say no. It was a little early in her career to be contemplating pro bono work. But, the accused deserved representation. The Bill of Rights said so. And he was innocent until proven guilty. And if the evidence was as bad as her father said it was, then the whole thing would be little more than a supervisory process. She would verify the case against him independently. Then she would advise him to plead guilty. Then she would watch his back as her father fed him through the machine. That was all. It could be seen as honest dues-paying, a constitutional chore, she hoped.
"Okay," she said. "He's innocent," Rosemary Barr said. "I'm sure of it." "They always are," Helen Roden thought. "Okay," she said again.
Then she told her new client to meet her in her office at 7 the next morning. It was like a test. A sister who really believed in her brother's innocence would show up for an early appointment. Rosemary Barr showed up right on time, at 7 o'clock on Monday morning. Franklin was there, too. He believed in Helen Roden and was prepared to defer his bills until he saw which way the wind was blowing. Helen Roden herself had already been at her desk for an hour. She had informed David Chapman of the change in representation on Sunday afternoon and had obtained the audio tape of his initial interview with James Barr. Chapman had been happy to hand it over and wash his hands. She had played the tape to herself a dozen times Sunday night and a dozen more that morning. It was all anyone had of James Barr. Maybe all anyone was ever going to get. So she had listened to it carefully, and she had drawn some early conclusions from it.
"Listen," she said.
She had the tape queued up and ready in an old-fashioned machine the size of a shoebox. She pressed play, and they all heard a hiss and breathing and room sounds, and then David Chapman's voice. "I can't help you if you won't help yourself." There was a long pause, full of more hiss, and then James Barr spoke.
"They got the wrong guy. They got the wrong guy," he said again.
Then Helen watched the tape counter numbers and spooled forward to Chapman saying, "Denying it is not an option." Then Barr's voice came through.
"Get Jack Reacher for me."
Helen spooled onward to Chapman's question.
Is he a doctor?
Then there was nothing on the tape except the sound of Barr beating on the interview room door.
Okay, Helen said. I think he really believes he didn't do it.
He claims as much, and then he gets frustrated and terminates the interview when Chapman doesn't take him seriously.
That's clear, isn't it?
He didn't do it, Rosemary Barr said.
I spoke with my father yesterday, Helen Roden said. The evidence is all there, Miss Barr. He did it, I'm afraid. You need to accept that a sister maybe can't know her brother as well as she'd like, or if she once did, that he changed for some reason.
There was a long silence.
Is your father telling you the truth about the evidence? Rosemary asked.
He has to, Helen said. We're going to see it all anyway. There's the discovery process. We're going to take depositions. There would be no sense in him bluffing at this point.
Nobody spoke.
But we can still help your brother, Helen said in the silence. He believes he didn't do it. I'm sure of that, after listening to the tape. Therefore, he's delusional now. Or at least he was on Saturday. Therefore, perhaps he was delusional on Friday, too.
How does that help him?
Rosemary Barr asked.
It's still admitting he did it.
The consequences will be different.
If he recovers. Time and treatment in an institution will be a lot better than time and no treatment in a maximum security prison.
You want to have James declared insane?
Helen nodded.
A medical defense is our best shot. And if we establish it right now, it might improve the way they handle him before the trial.
He might die. That's what the doctors said. I don't want him to die a criminal. I want to clear his name.
He hasn't been tried yet. He hasn't been convicted. He's still an innocent man in the eyes of the law.
That's not the same.
No, Helen said. I guess it isn't.
There was another long silence.
Let's meet back here at 10:30, Helen said. We'll thrash out a strategy. If we're aiming for a change of hospitals, we should try for it sooner rather than later.
We need to find this Jack Reacher person, Rosemary Barr said.
Helen nodded.
I gave his name to Emerson and my father.
Why?
Because Emerson's people cleared your brother's house out. They might have found an address or a phone number. And my father needed to know because we want this guy on our witness list, not the prosecution's, because he might be able to help us.
He might be an alibi.
Maybe an old army buddy at best.
I don't see how, Franklin said. They were different ranks and different branches.
We need to find him.
Rosemary Barr said.
James asked for him, didn't he? That has to mean something.
Helen nodded again.
I'd certainly like to find him. He might have something for us. Some exculpatory information, possibly. Or at least he might be a link to something we can use.
He's out of circulation, Franklin said.
He was 2 hours away, in the back of a bus out of Indianapolis. The trip had been slow, but pleasant enough. He had spent Saturday night in New Orleans in a motel near the bus depot. He had spent Sunday night in Indianapolis. So he had slept and fed himself and showered, but mostly he had rocked and swayed and dozed on buses, watching the passing scenes, observing the chaos of America, and surfing along on the memory of the Norwegian. His life was like that. It was a mosaic of fragments. Details and contexts would fade and be inaccurately recalled, but the feelings and the experiences would weave over time into a tapestry
equally full of good times and bad. He didn't know yet exactly where the Norwegian would fall. At that point, he thought of her as a missed opportunity, but she would have sailed away soon anyway, or he would have. CNN's intervention had shortened things, but maybe only by a fraction. The bus was doing 55 on Route 37, heading south. It stopped in Bloomington. Six people got out. One of them left the Indianapolis paper behind. Reacher picked it up and checked the sports. The Yankees were still ahead in the east. Then he flipped to the front and checked the news. He saw the headline, "Sniper Suspect Hurt in Jail Attack." He read the first three paragraphs. Brain injury. Coma. Uncertain prognosis. The journalist seemed torn between condemning the Indiana Board of Corrections for its lawless prisons and applauding Barr's attackers for doing their civic duty. This might complicate things, Reacher thought. The later paragraphs carried a reprise of the original crime story, plus updated background, plus new facts. Reacher read them all. Barr's sister had moved out of his house some months before the incident. The journalist seemed to think that was either a cause or an effect of Barr's evident instability, or both. The bus moved out of Bloomington. Reacher folded the paper and propped his head against the window and watched the road. It was a black ribbon, wet with recent rain, and it unspooled beside him with the center line flashing by like an urgent Morse code message. Reacher wasn't sure what it was saying to him. He couldn't read it. The bus pulled into a covered depot, and Reacher came out into the daylight and found himself 5 blocks west of where a raised highway curled around behind an old stone building. Indiana limestone, he guessed. The real thing. It would be a bank, he thought. Or a courthouse, or maybe a library. There was a black glass tower beyond it. The air was okay. It was colder than Miami, but he was still far enough south that winter felt safely distant. He wasn't going to have to refresh his wardrobe because of weather. He was in white chino pants and a bright yellow canvas shirt. Both were 3 days old. He figured he would get another day out of them. Then he would buy replacements. Cheap. He had brown boat shoes on his feet. No socks. He felt he was dressed for the boardwalk and thought he must look a little out of place in the city. He checked his watch. 9:20 in the morning. He stood on the sidewalk in the diesel fumes and stretched and looked around. The city was one of those heartland places that are neither large nor small, neither new nor old. It wasn't booming and it wasn't decrepit. There was probably some history. Probably some corn and soybean trading. Maybe tobacco. Maybe livestock. There was probably a river. Or a railhead. Maybe some manufacturing. There was a small downtown area. He could see it ahead of him, east of where he stood. Taller structures, some stone, some brick, some billboards. He figured the black glass tower would be the flagship building. No reason to build it anyplace else than the heart of downtown. He walked toward it. There was a lot of construction underway. Repairs, renewals, holes in the road, gravel piles, fresh concrete. Heavy trucks moving slow. He crossed in front of one and hit a side street and came out along the north side of a half-finished parking garage extension. He recalled Ann Yanni's fevered breaking news recap and glanced up at it and then away from it to a public square. There was an empty ornamental pool with a fountain spout sticking up forlornly in the center. There was a narrow walkway between the pool itself and a low wall. The walkway was decorated with makeshift funeral tributes. There were flowers with their stems wrapped in aluminum foil.
photographs under plastic, and small stuffed animals and candles. There was a dusting of leftover sand. The sand had soaked up the blood, he guessed.